Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello, everybody, and we begin today with unfolding drama in the Middle East. As the war in Syria gets even more intense, there are new questions about whether Assad would use chemical weapons if they become his last best military hope, and some evidence that he's preparing to do so. A movement is spreading in Egypt, meanwhile, to boycott the vote, not just vote no, on the proposed constitution that President Mohamed Morsi wants for the country. Opponents think it's too Islamist and would not protect individual rights. As Morsi calls out the military today in a new development, is it a new democracy in Egypt or authoritarian theocracy? Or maybe both. And for the Palestinians, what do you do differently now that the UN has recognized you as almost a state? Let's get a perspective from Leila Hilal, director of the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation. She has previously been a legal advisor to the Palestinian Authority in negotiations and constitution writing. Leila, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin in Egypt. As someone who has helped to draft a constitution in the region, how do you understand what President Morsi is trying to do and what the opponents object to?
Well, I when I look at Egypt, I see that Egypt is still in a revolutionary battle. So, yes, Hosni Mubarak, the former president of Egypt, was driven from power in January 2011. But the transitional process from authoritarian rule has been ad hoc and messy without a clear roadmap. So there are old and new forces that are currently engaged in a very long, drawn-out struggle for authority and legitimacy.
In fact, the headline this morning is that Morsi has now called on the military to maintain security until after the December 15th constitutional referendum. But you mentioned Mubarak. Isn't the Egyptian military the last vestige of the Mubarak era, with suspicion between the Morsi government and the military as to who would really be in charge as one of the dynamics of the last few months?
Well, the military has historically been an extremely important entity in Egypt. Nearly all Egyptian leaders have hailed from the military, and President Morsi is the first one who has not. But I would say that presently there are three main forces in Egypt, one being the military, as we discussed, who I would also point out is said to control up to 40% of Egypt's economy, so a very powerful force generally, and they have a lot of privilege that they seek to protect.
Linger on that thought for a minute. Yeah, how does a military control 40% of the economy? Is it defense contractors? What is it?
Well, it's partly that. It's partly that they have been able to gain subsidies and privileges for purchasing land, for building manufacturing plants. And they also receive $1.3 billion a year from the U.S. in defense contracts, for the most part, as well as some training. So it's a combination of economic investments and contracting. And it's been an obscure area of Egyptian politics that is being studied by many people at this point, and we are hoping to know more about it.
That's fascinating. So the military is one of the big three power centers then?
Right. The other is the Muslim Brotherhood, who the president of Egypt, Morsi, is from the Muslim Brotherhood Party. They have recently gained quite a bit of influence, both regionally, let's say even globally, and of course they have significant support inside Egypt. And you suggested that perhaps the Brotherhood and the military are at odds with each other because the military is a vestige of the former Mubarak regime. But what many people saw early on in the ascension of the Muslim Brotherhood is that they were negotiating with the military and willing to compromise with them on certain aspects of their power interests. So,
instance, that's becoming kind of a unified front?
Well, it's hard to say if it's a unified front, and people are still saying it's a question mark. But, for instance, in the draft constitution, which was pushed through at a very hastily pace in 2 days last week, in this draft constitution that's supposed to go to a national public referendum on the 15th, in that constitution, it preserves two very important privileges that the military has sought to maintain throughout this revolutionary struggle that we've seen in Egypt. One being shielding its budget from parliamentary scrutiny, and the other is to make the Minister of Defense a member of the military Supreme Council of Forces. And so the draft constitution that Morsi and the Brotherhood are endorsing and trying to push through very quickly against great opposition is holding on to those military privileges.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some question about what is at stake for a real transformation in the country from authoritarian rule to a new democracy.
Fascinating. So the military, the Muslim Brotherhood, and there's a third pillar of power in Egypt?
Yes. So, and this is a recent development, and one we can say is slightly more hopeful. And that is that there is a newly formed opposition coalition called the National Salvation Front. It's led now by the former international diplomat Mohammed al-Baradei, and it is inclusive of many of the youth groups, many of the people, the revolutionary forces who fought long and hard in January to achieve a transformation in their country. And you have different people coming together under this coalition of forces and standing together with a particular set of demands. The first being that Morsi rescind a constitutional declaration which had immunized him from judicial review, and also would also granted protection to the Constituent Assembly. They also have demanded that Mohamed Morsi not put the Constitution to a public referendum, and asking him to engage in a real, meaningful national dialogue.
Why would they want to not put the Constitution to a public referendum? This is where we get into, you know, some sticky questions about what's democracy and what's not democracy. Referendum, you know, to an American eye, an American ear, represents voting, represents the will of the people. So is there an attempt to impose an authoritarian government through a one-time vote? Or how do you think people should think about this referendum?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and one that we're seeing raised throughout the Arab world and within these uprisings, and that is, do elections actually signify real democracy? In many of these countries, Egypt included, when you have the fall of an authoritarian government that has held power through a very tight grip on society, when that power center disappears, you have new forces that are coming to the fore, and new issues of identity, such as the relationship between the state and Islam, the role of women, a whole set of social issues come to the fore. And I think there needs to be a process for the society, for the people of these nations to engage in discussion, debate about how to reconstruct the state, how to reformulate the social contract between the government and the people, and these identity issues. Now, with the Constituent Assembly in Egypt, there was a lot of controversy over this assembly because through competitive elections, 75% of the seats of the Constituent Assembly went to Islamist forces. And as these representatives were drafting the constitution, liberal, secular, minority representatives started to walk out of the assembly because they felt that their interests were not represented in the constitution and that the actual process of drafting was not inclusive enough. So now the idea is if you put forward this constitution, which doesn't have broad-based legitimacy in the public mind to many people in Egypt, is a referendum meaningful one way or the other? And there have been many people who were formerly supporters of President Morsi or who were associated with the Islamists who have called for the referendum not to happen or who have called on people to vote no or have been calling for a boycott. So you have a diversity of voices in Egypt. It's not Islamist versus non-Islamist mm-hmm. who are saying that, in fact, we need more time to work through what we want to be as a nation.
Let's take a phone call before we move on to Syria and the Palestinian Authority post-UN vote. Here is Hassan in Manhattan, originally from Egypt. Hassan, thank you for calling up.
How are you doing, Brian?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
What are you
thinking? What I'm talking about now is about this and the Democrats and people, they don't like Morsi and all of that. And I don't know what the Democrats mean to them. If you get elected by the people, all right, and he's the president of the country, and they get against him, they lost. Those who lost the election, they're still fighting to get their the presenting from him. Now, why they don't give him a chance?
Right, and they lost. You're saying they lost the election. But Hassan, we know that one of the cornerstones of democracy is not just majority rule voting, but protecting minorities from the tyranny of the majority. It's certainly an issue in this country. And now religious and secular minorities are afraid that their individual rights won't be protected from a majority Islamist parliament, for example. What would you say about that concern?
Okay. What you're talking about, the Christian in Egypt, they get more help from him than Mubarak, okay? None of the Christian or the Coptic in Egypt, they get anything against them. Even they get more power and more freedom than what happened with Mubarak, okay? And what this opposition they try to take to tell you about women and the Christian and all of that, women there in Egypt, they have more power than any other country in the world. And not in the world, in other countries.
In the region. Know? Hassan, thank you very much for chiming in on that. And before we do move on to Syria, Leila Hilal from the New America Foundation, what do you think about his specific points? Do you think that the Coptic Christian minority has more rights today under the Morsi government than they did under Mubarak and that women have more rights?
Well, I think that under the new constitution, the draft constitution, if it goes through, there are many provisions in it which, on the face of it, don't take away rights, but will allow a judge, an official, to interpret the right in a manner which scales back individual liberties. But I take the point that elected officials have legitimacy in the sense that they've been put in power by the people, and we should respect that. But the question has been, what has Morsi done with that power? And secondly, the constitution, the new constitution for a new Egypt, becomes a very important document for building consensus going forward. And whether or not you have a whole host of people, Islamists, non-Islamists, who are concerned about this constitution. The Al-Azhar, the prestigious Islamist Institute, has come out and called, spoken out against a referendum of this constitution. So I think whether you're elected or non-elected, whether you're a minority or a part of the 90% Muslim majority, many Egyptians want to see a more inclusive transitional process, and that certainly is the way to build stability. And I think that that's why we have to get behind a process that has more buy-in by a wider group of people, that isn't just based on majoritarian rule.
My guest on WNYC for another few minutes is Leila Hilal, director of the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation think tank. Then we'll talk to the city's Human Resources Administration Commissioner Robert Doerr about a temporary expansion of food stamp eligibility in New York City because of Sandy. Maybe this will include you. But let's move on to Syria for a minute or two. Leila, the U.S. and U.N. are raising concerns that the Assad regime is preparing chemical weapons for use. Do you know how good the evidence is about preparations?
Well, I think the U.S. Has internal intelligence that is the best evidence, and I cannot speak to that with any kind of real authority. I think that there are real concerns. But I think really what is provoking the concern about Syria is that what you see on the ground is the insurgency, the rebels who are fighting the Assad regime are making very significant gains, where people are predicting that there may be a tipping point on the verge shortly, that Assad's time and power is limited. So, yes, there is some concern about the use of chemical weapons, but there is also a deepening anxiety on the part of the international community that they are not prepared for a post-Assad era, because we know right now that all the insurgents are fighting against the Assad regime. But if the Assad regime were to end, what will happen with these armed groups? There are more than 1,000 military units in the country. Will they fight each other? Who will try to dominate and control? And I think my analysis would be that is causing more anxiety amongst Western.
So what would be the first step? Because here we are again, like with Egypt, talking about what happens after the dictator falls. And in Egypt, at least that was born of the protests in Tahrir Square and this, you know, massive outpouring in the street for change and a more open society. It's being born by civil war with, you know, lots of uncertainty as to who represents who in Syria. So what would happen after the Assad regime falls, and what role would you see the United States playing or debating whether to play in that?
It's a hard question. I think that the Syrians have been calling on the U.S. to intervene for a long time, since the Assad regime started responding to the protests in his country. Now more than 40,000 Syrians have been killed. So I think the U.S. has really lost some credibility within Syria, and its ability to come in at this point very late in the game and help establish order is a big question mark. What I think would be useful is to have perhaps a regional coalition of actors backed by Western nations that can help establish a peacekeeping force in a post-Assad scenario. And I would just add that the Syrians have been very active during this long and bloody revolution and civil conflict to build a transitional framework and to try to build consensus on what the process of moving toward toward something that more closely resembles a democracy looks like. So there are many plans in place that could potentially help us avoid the very messy situation in Egypt. But of course, in Syria, there are other very deeper social social
divisions.
Questions. Yes,
we're already over time, but I do want to at least give you one response on what's going on with the Palestinians. As someone who has worked for the Palestinian Authority, I gather, in negotiations with Israel and on constitutional writing, the UN granting observer status last week, what does it change, practically speaking? The biggest thing I keep hearing in the media is the Palestinian Authority could now bring accusations against the Israeli military in the International Criminal Court. Do you expect that to actually happen, or what else do you think UN observer status would actually mean?
It's largely a symbolic change in status. The Palestinians would have to go through multiple steps in order to reach the International Criminal Court. They would have to make an argument that they are a state, and then that the court would have to grant that status. So it's a long shot, and I don't see any indication that they are going to take up that battle immediately. But what is important about what happened at the UN is that the European countries, many of them, broke ranks with the U.S. and supported the resolution and or abstained, which means that you now also have the Europeans who are part of the political map in terms of how we get to a resolution of this conflict. And so that is an important piece to watch going forward. And there are many people who are saying that because the U.S. Voted against this resolution, which is in favor of a policy they support, a two-state solution, that the U.S. is increasingly isolating themselves. So I think there is a question about who is going to be influential in moving the process forward, should one be re-engaged in the future.
And by the way, we're doing a segment later in the program on think tanks, following on Jim DeMint leaving the Senate to head for the Heritage Foundation. And we're asking, do think tanks actually think, or do they just advocate for predetermined political or partisan positions? And looking at some of the key people involved with your group, the New America Foundation, Steve Call, Michael Lind, Eric Schmidt from Google, I guess I would tend to call it center-left, less liberal than the Center for American Progress, but definitely not conservative. But how do you see the New America Foundation, and how do you see your role as a think tank thinker?
Well, the New America Foundation is independent and nonpartisan by definition, and it is filled with a number of individuals who are not necessarily coordinating their position on any one thing. Rather, what is valued and emphasized here at New America is supporting fresh perspective, new voices, without any particular control over what should and shouldn't be said. We value independence, evidence-based analysis, smart analysis from a fresh perspective.
Would center-left be a usable shorthand?
Yes, I think I describe it as progressive. Mm-hmm. Meaning progressive in the sense of looking for solutions and not being bounded by any sort of partisan constraints.
Leila Hilal, director of the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation. She has previously been a legal advisor to the Palestinian Authority in negotiations and constitution writing. Thank you so much for your insights into Egypt, Syria, and the PA.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we have the expanded food stamp eligibility news. This is for some New York City neighborhoods affected by Sandy, but you only have a week to apply. We'll talk to the head of the city's Human Resources Administration, who will explain. Stay with us.